Greetings, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio. You're here live with host LaVon. Happy to be here. Happy Friday. It's September 23rd, 2016. Got lots of headlines to read to you guys this evening from theantimedia.org. Go there to read along with me, or if you'd like to call in and discuss anything, the number is 1-718-717-8296. I look forward to talking to you if you feel like chatting. Otherwise, we're going to get straight to it because there's a lot going on. As usual, we're going to start right at the top here with our first headline. So we're still seeing a media blackout by ABC, NBC, and all other major conventional media outlets regarding the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, which has been quite prevalent the last at least 2 weeks. This story was published by Nick Burnaby today. Let's see here. North Dakota. I didn't want to be right last month when I predicted the media's blackout of the North Dakota Access Pipeline. Protests after the blockade first started generating a buzz on social media, but I was. According to media watchdog Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, ABC and NBC News have yet to broadcast a single mention of the protest, which have brought the $3.8 billion oil pipeline project at the Sacred Stone Camp in North Dakota to a halt. Fair searched the Nexus News database, which tracks media coverage, and found these so-called news outlets haven't covered double controversy at all. Fair noted that by September 7th, CBS alone of the three major broadcast news networks hadn't aired anything on Dakota Access, and that was a lone report on CBS Morning News, amounting to 48 words read at 4 o'clock in the morning. CBS has since covered the story several times. Other news outlets that were initially part of Hold on 1 second here. Wouldn't be typical without a computer error here. For some reason, my computer just switched articles on me. Give me just a moment. Oh, come on. Be my friend. Come on. Come on. Come on. So, again, if you guys want to call me, the number is 1-718-717-8296. Come on. Seriously, I just need to switch tabs. Well, let me switch tabs. Okay, so I'm going to try and read this other news story that's open in front of me, if it'll let me scroll down here. Oh my gosh. So I'm using a new computer because I was trying to negate all these problems we have every week. And I still have them. Dream Team producer / co-host, if you're out there, now's the best time to reach out to me. Seriously, my new computer froze, and it will not let me fucking click on this fucking story I'm trying to read. I'm gonna throw it off the patio, guys. Help! I'm just trying to read this first one. Like, I'm trying to read that one, that tab right there. What does that mean? I'm reading that one right there. Does this even make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
It's just your flesh. Yay! 1 second, guys. Homegirl's helping me out.
Probably use something else besides Firefox. Firefox tends to freeze.
Really?
Yeah. There you go.
Okay. Noted. Fuck you, Firefox. Okay, sorry guys. Thought we were gonna have a smooth, awesome show. Okay, back to what we were saying. CBS has since covered the story several times. Other news outlets that were initially part of the media blackout began covering the DAPL protest only after they went mainstream on social media. Curiously enough, all of the major broadcasters found time in their busy schedules to treat Brad and Angelina Jolie's divorce as top news. Blech. Vomit just reading that shit. How's that for priorities? Unlike the corporate broadcast media, anti-media has consistently covered the No DAPL protest. You can find all of our coverage here. There's an awesome link. Please follow it if you guys are unfamiliar with what I'm talking about. But Nick continues to say that in his August article, he speculated about the reasons for the media blackout, especially considering a fairly similar, albeit inconsequential, land dispute at the Mueller Wildlife Refuge in Oregon received nonstop media coverage from every outlet. You can find my conclusions here. And he goes on to elaborate with that story. But isn't that strange, though, that our society seriously spends more time talking about drama and what's the word? Not inappropriate, but just the things that really have no value to our existence. We're so distracted by who's having sex with who, divorcing who's impregnating who cares. I mean, on a community level, it matters, definitely. But grand news, all of our major news outlets should be really educating people towards their optimal wellness. And I don't think being concerned with the drama within other people's relationships is going to support that. But that's just me. Our next headline here is Big Pharma spent nearly $1 billion lobbying the government to push opiates, and it worked. How exciting. So this is posted by the Miss Alice Sells. Sells? Am I saying that right? Probably not. So this is an opinion-oriented article, and she begins by saying the pharmaceutical industry is often the target of relentless criticism. But while the concerns brought up by said big pharma critics are often legitimate and unsettling, they are also the product of heavy government intervention. Because misdiagnosing the disease, in this case, big pharma's influence and its consequence, has been the standard approach among reformists. Proposed media solutions continue to kill patients. In other words, as reformists propose still more regulation and government involvement, Americans who fell victim to the cozy relationship between big pharma and government continue to suffer. Going deeper and finding the root of the problem is the approach, but only if your goal is to truly solve the problem. When honest doctors see a problem, they let their patients know, whether the truth hurts or not. As a nation, we must have difficult conversation on this topic, and unfortunately, some of what we'll learn will be upsetting. Big Pharma lobby more powerful than ever. As reported by Mother Jones, the opioid crisis in America has worsened considerably, in part because Big Pharma lobbyists continue to spend money to influence Congress. So far, Mother Jones reports the pharmaceutical industry has spent $880 million to deter lawmakers from passing legislation that restricts patient access to opioids. As the number of accidental fentanyl overdoses increases, prompting police officers to carry Narcan when responding to calls, The opioid lobby has been doing everything it can to preserve the status quo of aggressive prescribing. According to Dr. Andrew Kolodny, an opioid reform advocate, He says, to combat the crisis, which started to alarm some lawmakers several years ago, state lawmakers in New Mexico tackled the issue by reviewing a bill sponsored by former Democratic Senator Bernadette Sanchez in 2012 that would have limited initial opioid prescriptions for acute pain to seven-day doses within state borders. Senator Sanchez hoped to make addiction less likely and provide fewer pills that could be resold on the black market. But the application of the drug war approach, meaning more restrictions on drug commerce, to yet another dependency issue, has eventually failed at the state level, thanks mostly to lobbyists working for Big Pharma. Senator Sanchez told the Associated Press, but the industry's fight against restrictions has just started. Because prescription restrictions like the one proposed in New Mexico would have impaired their money-making game plan, the industry continued with its aggressive campaign to gain support from the public. Every year, the Daily Beast reported in 2015, pharmaceutical companies spend over $3 billion on direct-to-consumer ads. And unfortunately, these ads work. A patient who requests a specific drug will get it most of the time, the Daily Beast notes. With government rules making it hard for doctors to say no, it's easy to see why so many people are able to maintain their addictions. Big Pharma has never ceased to influence us through leading physicians, who often get to influence prescribing practices. Pharmaceutical money that goes to academic physicians and research continues to flow freely. As the Daily Beast explained, these physician leaders get to influence prescribing practices, since researchers and consultants are, well, experts. The result is predictable. Since practicing physicians are influenced far more by guidelines, esteemed academic physicians, and opinion pieces in prestigious journals than we are by a deli platter and a smiling drug representative, pharmaceutical companies invest a great deal of their money and time into swaying doctors' opinions and keeping them favorable to their products. I can attest to this after working in several doctors' offices. By combining heavy advertising to patients with their aggressive bribing of leading physicians, pharmaceutical leaders are also able to sway official guidelines and regulations. Since at least $1.4 billion of pharmaceutical money went to research in 2013, it's safe to say some doctors are heavily influenced by pharmaceutical research monies. And while little data is available on the link between industry-backed research and the public policy, a study from 2003 entitled Scope and Impact of Financial Conflicts of Interest in Biomedical Research showed about 43% of all scientific investigators involved with academic research had received gifts and discretionary funds from industry sponsors. The study concluded that financial relationships among industry, scientific investors, and academic institutions are widespread, and conflicts of interest arising from these ties can influence biomedical research in important ways. Government agencies are packed with industry professionals. Government regulatory bodies like the U.S. Food and Drug Administration only allow drug-related products to be sold in the United States once the company is capable of submitting evidence that the drug is safe and effective. Regulators rely heavily on research provided by the industry. That research is then reviewed and approved by doctors at the FDA Center of Drug Evaluation and Research. An organization that employs physicians such as Michael Klein, PhD, as a controlled substance staff director, Klein also happens to serve as the vice president of Stellar Biotechnologies Incorporated, the company behind the production of keyhole limpet hemokinin, which is a safe immunostimulating protein with an extensive history of use in vaccine development and immunological research. Sipes, who serves as director of the CDER Office of Regulatory Policy, is a former partner at the business and corporate law firm Covington and Burlington. Her husband, Christopher Sipes, is the attorney who represented biopharmaceutical company Amarin Corporation in a suit against the FDA that eventually granted 5-year new chemical entity marketing exclusivity for Vascepa, which is a certain type of capsule, to the company. Members of the government board responsible for reviewing, accepting, or refusing drug applications are directly involved with the pharmaceutical industry, making it clear how deep the pharmaceutical industry's influence runs. As a government official, an ongoing war against substances such as heroin remains in full force, the pharmaceutical industry continues waging its own war for influence, employing an average of 1,350 lobbyists in state capitals from Olympia to Tallahassee, while fighting hard to keep illicit drugs illicit. If the revolving door is the problem, what is the solution? With pharmaceutical industry leaders employing former government officials and vice versa, the fight to sway public policies in a way that benefits special interests is ongoing, and it's cost these companies a great deal of money. These same companies are only able to engage in this influence war because they hold monopolies over the products they produce and market. So proposing more restrictions on these organizations, whether or not they are the reason we have an opioid epidemic in the first place, is misguided simply because more restrictions will only boost these very monopolies. Instead, how about putting an end to the very agency that allows this corporate welfare game to continue? According to economist Mark removing the regulatory burden from the government could benefit patients by letting pharmaceutical companies sell whichever medications they believe to be safe and effective, with the understanding that patients can win large judgments if the companies fail to produce and market their treatments responsibly. In the absence of an authority figure telling consumers which companies are safe, he contends that competition will thrive, and smaller, more patient-oriented groups will emerge to respond to a real demand for quality products. That's a great article. And it's true, there's a lot of misinformation regarding drugs, and you can see its insanity clearly demonstrated when you're watching an infomercial, whatever the hell you call it, a commercial, or a program, if you will, for a drug commercial. They say, we'll help your depression, but may include bleeding from the eyes, suicidal thoughts, and most likely death. And yet people still go and request them. So there's so much misinformation that people completely ignore the part where it doesn't actually help you. It may make you worse, but you need it anyway. So you guys know how I feel about the conventional medicine. We're not getting into that. We're going on to our next article here, which is about Stephen Hawking. He released a chilling warning to scientists searching for alien life. Ooh, exciting. So this is by the lovely Carrie Wiedler. She wrote this today. She says that Stephen Hawking is known for offering insightful and often scary commentary on the universe and technology. The world-renowned theoretical physicist and cosmologist has cautioned against rapidly evolving artificial intelligence, humans exploiting and destroying Earth, and Donald Trump becoming one of the most powerful men on the planet. Now, he's warning scientists and humanity in general against becoming too friendly with alien life. Oh my gosh, how exciting. No, not. Hawking hosts a show called Stephen Hawking's Favorite Places on the Science Theme subscription service CuriosityStream. During the half-hour broadcast, CNET explains he flies by the potentially habitable Habitatable. Exoplanet, Jealousy, A32C in a CGI spaceship as part of his hypothetical dream itinerary for a tour of the universe. It's quite a sentence there. Hawking intends to scan for signs of intelligent life using powerful radio telescopes, which he's using in a new $100 million project with Mark Zuckerberg and internet investor Yuri Milner. They intend to determine whether they can successfully send a swarm of tiny spacecraft, each weighing far less than an ounce, to the Alpha Centauri star system in search of intelligent life. The Toronto Sun reported this in April. On his show, however, Stephen Hawking explains that if intelligent life has evolved on Jealousy, I don't even know how to say that word, which is 16 light years away from Earth, his radio telescopes would be able to detect it. However, he warns one day we might receive a signal from a planet like this, but we should be very wary of answering back. Meeting an advanced civilization could be like the Native Americans encountering Columbus, and that didn't turn out so well. Hawking has made his comparison before and regularly presents analogies between intelligent life and alien colonial, oh my God, I can't read today, colonialism. Though his suggestion we avoid communicating with them appears to be new. Last year, while arguing it's mathematically likely aliens exist in the universe, he said, "To my mathematical brain, the numbers alone make thinking about aliens perfectly rational. The real challenge is to work out what aliens might actually be like." In 2010, he suggested they may be eager to control other planets. "I imagine they might exist in massive ships, having used up all the resources from their home planet. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads, looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach." Still, he is open to viewing the human race as nomadic, as well as acknowledging Earthlings that face a range of threats, whether they are environmental, nuclear, or they come from another planet. As he said last year, "I think the survival of the human race will depend on its ability to find new homes elsewhere in the universe, because there's an increasing risk that a disaster will destroy Earth. Indeed, scientists are actively looking for habitable planets, and some of their discoveries have preliminary potential. Whether aliens come to us or we begin to colonize outer space, according to Stephen Hawking, they might be more like us than we imagine, and that's a threat to our survival." Well, of course it's mathematically possible that they exist. It's idiotic to think that they're not. However, I think that if I were an alien trying to invade a planet where there was an advanced, quote unquote, intelligence, I would not make myself visible within their visual spectrum. I would, in fact, be like a tiny bacteria, and I would invade their bodies and like control them from the inside. You know, like how some people have parasites. Those are fucking aliens. You
War of
can't
the
tell me
Worlds.
otherwise. War of the
That's
Worlds?
what that movie was about.
That's what that's about. So I'm not the only one who thinks this. Like, I would not be like, "Hey, take me to your leader. Here's my ship about to blow you up." No, I would be like, "I'm about to invade your body, like a sneaky little sneak, and control you from the inside."
Yeah, War of the Worlds was like in the
That's an old book.
40s
Yeah, that's an
or
old
so.
Same guy who wrote
And there was
Time
Invasion of
Machine. What's his
H.G.
name?
Wells.
H.G. Wells, yeah.
And then there was also Invasion of the Body Snatchers, was about that.
It's a thing, guys. The aliens are in you. Don't be freaked out or anything. Let's go on to our next story. So, this is not a laughing matter. I saw this video today, shot by the wife of Keith Lamont Scott. And finally, we've been able to see a different perspective of the shooting that occurred not long ago, taking this man's life. And Nick Burnaby reports that in Charlotte, North Carolina, Video from the police shooting of Keith Lamont Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina, on Tuesday has finally emerged. Scott's wife filmed the video, obtained by NBC News, during the standoff with police. Witness claimed that Keith Lamont Scott was unarmed and holding a book at the time police shot him, though police accounts maintain he had a gun, which looks a lot different than a book, but we'll continue. In the video, Scott's wife says he is unarmed and has just taken his medicine. Moments later, police fire 4 shots and he can be seen lying on the ground. So there is a video, if you guys want to watch it, on our webpage at theantimedia.org. It's very graphic. But, unfortunately, the video does not clear up conflicting accounts from witnesses and police regarding whether or not Keith Lamont Scott was armed. The shooting has triggered ongoing protests in Charlotte as activists demand justice and transparency, full transparency in the shooting. North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory declared a state of emergency, calling upon the state's National Guard, and Mayor Jennifer Roberts imposed an indefinite midnight curfew after protests on Tuesday and Wednesday turned into minor riots. Protesters are calling for police to make body cam footage of the shooting public. Police Chief Kerr Putney has refused to release the footage thus far. Scott's death follows the release of video showing police shooting another black man in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where officers gunned down Terrence Crutcher after his car reportedly broke down on the highway. The video shows Crutcher with his hands in the air before he was shot by police officer Betty Shelby. Police Chief Chuck Jordan said no weapon was found on Crutcher or at the scene of the shooting, and Shelby has since been charged with manslaughter, which, honestly, I'm surprised. Through all these massive killings that we've seen blatantly, increasingly happen in our country, we have yet to see an officer who hasn't been discharged with pay, which is fucking bullshit. And I can understand why riots continue to happen, but Shelby was charged with manslaughter. But still, tensions between communities and law enforcement in the United States have run high since the police killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, 2014. U.S. police forces have come under scrutiny for being over-militarized, you think, and trigger-happy, especially in black communities. Since 2014, U.S. police have killed on average over 1,000 Americans per year. We're 9 months into this year, and so far the number is 791. What do you guys think about this? It's obviously a major controversy in our country where people are arguing over whose lives matter more, when the point is that we do live in a police state. Our police should not carry guns. We are smart populace. We can think of other ways to detain people in a non-lethal way. I'm just going to leave it at that. And people are going to continue to riot and demand justice until things change. And you can't get mad at people for doing that, because there's clearly something going wrong. And let's go on to talk about this correction officer, which is, corrections officers are the ones who basically babysit people after police arrest them. And they, too, are also known to very much so abuse of power. And this article is titled, Lawsuit Claims Corrections Officers Gassed and Tortured Inmate to Death. This is also by Alice, written today. She says that this Monday, an attorney representing the 12-year-old daughter of Randall Jordan Aparo, a 27-year-old inmate who was killed while in the custody of the Franklin Correctional Institution, filed a lawsuit against the Florida Department of Corrections in a Tallahassee federal court. According to the suit, which was brought forward by the 12-year-old's mother, Amanda Cimillo, Jordan Aparo, was tortured beaten and gassed to death in March of 2010 by FDC corrections officers. The man had been serving time for credit card fraud when his lifeless body was found in his cell. The suit alleges he was naked except for his boxer shorts at the time of his death. Jordan Aparo suffered from a hereditary blood disorder known as Osler-Weber-Rendu syndrome, and according to the suit, his condition had worsened in the months prior to his killing. Records obtained by the Miami Herald show that in the days before his death, Jordan Aparo began experiencing bleeding problems, complained of severe back pain, and had a fever of 102 degrees. His lungs and heart were hurting, and he was having a difficult time breathing. Despite his medical condition, the lawsuit alleges correction officers, doctors, and nurses at the prison denied him medical attention. As a prisoner complained about the lack of care, threatening to sue the nurses, demanding that they take him to the hospital, officers placed him in an isolation cell where he would be gassed until he could no longer breathe. The more Jordan Aparo complained, the more he was gassed, the report adds. In all, he was subject to 600 grams of chemical agents in a confined space, well over lethal levels, according to an investigation by the Miami Herald in 2014. Photographs of the man's dead body show hair, legs, toes, and mouth covered in orange residue, a byproduct of the spray used by the guards. The suit makes the case that officers murdered Jordan Aparo and that nurses, doctors, and the warden all conspired to cover up their actions prior to his killing by removing evidence, doctor reports, and threatening witnesses. According to the Miami Herald, this is not the first lawsuit in which the FDC has been accused of negligence in cases of wrongful inmate deaths. Due to their similarities, many of the suits claim the agency has a history of corruption that involves destroying and destroying evidence to hide the suspicious death of Florida prisoners. Jordan Aparo's killing is eerily similar to the deaths of other prisoners whose names are listed in these suits, such as Darren Rainey, a mentally ill 50-year-old inmate who was placed in a scalding shower at Dade Correctional Institute in 2012. Other cases include the death of Ricky Martin, a 24-year-old who was beaten by a fellow inmate as officers passed by his cell in 2012 as well. Romel Johnson, an asthmatic 44-year-old suffering from severe breathing problems, who was also gassed in confinement in 2010. Also, Matthew Walker, a 47-year-old inmate who was beaten and his larynx was crushed so badly that his throat was swollen shut. He was killed by Charlotte Correctional Institutional Corrections Officer in 2014. FDC officers and staff members were never charged in any of these cases. Prior to the Jordan Aparo suit, a federal civil rights lawsuit was also filed on behalf of Frank Smith, a 44-year-old who was allegedly beaten so severely by a corrections officer that he was left paralyzed and died several months later from massive head trauma. Both the Federal Bureau of Investigations and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement are investigating Jordan Aparo's death, which has also been named in additional lawsuits involving FTC's officers who claim the agency retaliated against them for alleging cover-ups, inmate abuse, and political interference on behalf of a company whose lead lobbyist became the governor's general counsel. From the Miami Herald, in June, a state panel ruled that the prison agency violated its own policies by stacking up allegations against one of the investigators, Doug Gilson, and spending more time investigating him on trumped-up charges than they did investigating claims of abuse on inmates by staff, as in the case of Jordan Aparo. The suit filed against the FTC by officers alleges that the Office of Governor Rick Scott has wielded influence over the agency's investigations, accusing both the governor's former top lawyer, Pete Antonassi, and his chief inspector general, Melinda Miguel, of involvement. One of the three prison inspectors suing the agency, Aubrey Land, gave a tape recording interview with detailed evidence of a cover-up to Chief Inspector General Miguel in 2013. And to this date, Land has not been approached by either the FBI or the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. One of my family members used to work as a corrections officer for many years and retired from that job. And I know that it's very typical that inmates are beaten, and if they're fighting, even in a lethal situation, it's often ignored. Just because correctional officers don't want to get involved, and they frankly don't give a fuck. Like, it's kind of like a brotherhood where they all support each other in the beating of the inmates. And they are treated like dogs. And that's just the way it is. And until we continue to build more prisons and colleges and arrest people for dumb charges, it's not going to get any better. So it's just one, it's a grain within the satchel of problems that we've created. So, this is interesting. This was also posted today on our site. Quite busy. Lots of news today. By one of our admins. Then this is titled, "The Pentagon Seeks 500 More Ground Troops in Iraq for Mosul Invasion." So, with officials saying that the planned invasion of the city of Mosul could begin as soon as October, the Pentagon is once again requesting more U.S. ground troops to be deployed into the area around the city. The Pentagon has already deployed several hundred troops multiple times in the last 2 months on the same basis. The Pentagon is seeking another 500 permanent U.S. troops in Iraq, which would bring the official figure in the country to 4,900. In practice, the Pentagon already is believed to have in excess of 6,000 troops in Iraq, but labels many of them temporary and doesn't count them, despite their deployments not having any specific date. The new deployment, as with previous few, would have the troops sent to Kura Air Base, which Iraq forces occupied back in July. Despite presenting the capture of the base as a great military victory, ISIS has abandoned it long ago, and the hundreds of U.S. troops already there are mostly just helping fix the damage of last year's U.S. airstrikes on the base. The plan is to use it as a staging area in the invasion of Mosul, and while officials have previously claimed that the U.S. troops would primarily be there for logistics purposes, it is expected that many will be embedded into the Iraqi forces. Honestly, are we ever going to leave there? I don't know. On to some delicious talk about Burger King and Jack in the Box. Apparently, they're getting slammed for using antibiotics in their food. This is another article posted by Carrie yesterday. She goes on to say that, she begins to say that King in the Box, Dunkin' Donuts, Arby's, and a number of other fast food companies and restaurants are failing to reduce antibiotics in their animal livestock, according to a new joint analysis conducted by leading environmental and consumer groups. Chain Reaction 2 was released this week by the Natural Resources Defense Council, Friends of the Earth, and the Consumers Union, and the Center for Food Safety, and the Food Animal Concerns Trust. These groups analyzed the major fast food and restaurant brands' use of antibiotics in its meat based on survey responses from the companies. The researchers caution that while some establishments have made progress, the heavy use of antibiotics. Wait a second. The heavy use of human antibiotics in animals is contributing to the serious public health risk of antibiotic resistance. The mass majority. Whoa. I'm so tired. I'm switching the first letters. Okay. Start over, guys. The vast majority of this meat is produced in industrial scale facilities where thousands and even tens of thousands of animals at a time are routinely fed antibiotics to help them survive and make them grow faster in ridiculously unsanitary and crowded, stressful conditions. The report's introduction explains, noting this misuse of antibiotics contributes to the antibiotic resistance, the ability of bacteria to withstand exposure to an antibiotic. According to the analysis, Chipotle and Panera were the only two establishments to receive an A grade for their efforts to phase out antibiotic use. This means they have policies limiting the routine use of antibiotics across all the meat and poultry they serve, and publicly affirming that a majority of their meat and poultry is sourced accordingly. Subway, which previously faced a public relations disaster for using a yoga mat chemical on their bread, received a B grade.
Yoga mat sandwiches.
Yeah, yoga mat. So, like, it's like the best way to do yoga, right? From the inside out, you just eat Subway. Boom! That should be their new campaign. Fuckers, don't use that. I will sue the shit out of you. Anyways, I wouldn't. I don't care. Through last year, they received an F. Though last year, they received an F. This year, they are the only new restaurant chain to adapt a new antibiotics policy that applies to all types of meat it serves. The analysis reports roughly two-thirds of Subway chicken is now antibiotic-free. Congratulations, you got figured out, and all of a sudden you care about people. Also known as, you're an asshole. On to the next paragraph here. The only other claim... I can't read any words. The only other chain to receive a B grade was Chick-fil-A, which received the same grade last year. The popular restaurant reports that more than 23% of its chicken supply was raised without antibiotics, indicating only marginal progress over the last year. Though the reports express caution and optimism that standards for chicken are improving across the industry, it warns most companies have not applied these new standards to the rest of their meats, like Panera and Chipotle have. McDonald's was one such example. The fast food giant received a C+ for its effort to reduce antibiotic use in chicken. 100% of its chicken is now reportedly raised without antibiotics, important in human medicine. But the chain still failed to achieve a higher grade, though they have enthusiastically promoted news of their progress on poultry. They have said no such policies have been implemented regarding their beef or pork. Wendy's received a C, Taco Bell received a C-, and the grades deteriorated from there. From the report, two other companies, Pizza Hut and Papa John's, received a D for making token efforts, also known as setting good antibiotics use policies on chicken, but applying them only to a small fraction of their chicken purchases. Unfortunately, 16 of the top fast food chains, including such very large ones as KFC and Burger King, have taken no action to reduce the use of antibiotics in their supply chains. These companies have received an F. An F for fucking up. KFC, Dunkin' Donuts, Arby's, Applebee's, Jack in the Box, Sonic Burger, Chili's, Dairy Queen, Domino's, Little Caesars, IHOP, Buffalo Wild Wings, Burger King, Olive Garden, and Denny's all received failing grades. Holy moly. The widespread of use in antibiotics in livestock is a major public health concern. Talk to you guys about this. It's a super horrible thing. The overprescription of antibiotics in humans is itself a growing issue, but as the report explains, 70% of antibiotics important for human medicine sold in the US are used in livestock and poultry production, not for human medical use. Oh my God, fuck this country. The use of antibiotics in livestock has risen to 23% in the last 5 years, contributing to the growing problem, also known as MRSA. Seriously, you know about superbugs? Ugh, this is how they're born, dude.
I follow the anti-media.
Oh my gosh, guys, we have a fan here. She gets to see all my mistakes behind the scenes. Let's see here. I'm getting the heebie-jeebies. This kind of shit pisses me off to like the point where I want to go rage and burn down pharmaceutical companies. Like, if they all burned down, it was me. I did it. Antibiotic resistance makes treatment of bacterial infections harder, increases how long people are sick, and makes it more likely that people will die. Curbing the misuse of antibiotics in the meat industry is a public health imperative, the report urges. They also point out that approximately 90% of the antibiotics sold for animal uses are added to feed and water, and that this practice is a key contributor to the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria called superbugs, which can escape from the farm and spread through communities via air, water, soil, meat, and even via workers. Though the report focused on antibiotic use, it warns of other additives used in meat in the United States, including zinc, copper, growth hormones, and debilitating beta agonists like receptomine. Nice. Sounds so good. I'm hungry now. In spite of the widespread use of multiple additives in livestock, the report remains optimistic. Why? Because they note that 9 out of 25 companies surveyed, up from 5 in 2015, had adopted publicly available policies that phase out routine antibiotics use in some or all of their meat and poultry supply. McDonald's, Subway, Chick-fil-A, Wendy's, Taco Bell, Chipotle, Panera, Papa John's, and Pizza Hut. They also praise consumers for demanding better options. The market for meat and poultry raised without routine antibiotic use is growing fast, and they note that citing grass-fed and organic options. Still, the research advises more must be done to make a substantial impact on the food supply, calling for more government involvement, which they say has been woefully inadequate. They also call for more effort from the fast food chains and restaurants, which they say can create a positive ripple effects on meat production practices across the country by changing their sourcing policies.
Those bitches.
These bitches. Okay, let me get some water in me because I'm about to rant so hard. Is a major problem in our country when most of the people are living in poverty and fear, barely surviving check to check, spending all of their time at a JOB, basically trading their lives for money to pay for shit that they don't need or they can't afford, just to do it all over again. So they're perpetually trapped in the system. I don't care who you are, if you're a student, if you're a doctor, you're still trapped in that same system because it's set up to fail. And most of these people either don't know how to cook because they didn't learn because their parents were stuck in the same system, and they have no choice economically or physically sometimes because they've been working so hard. You know this is true. You know I'm talking about most of you right now. So their go-tos are most likely one of the restaurants that I just above read from the above article here. And let's see, 9 out of 25 publicly have public available policies that indicate the phasing out of routine antibiotics in their meat and poultry supply, that's not enough. Because there is a massive rippling effect, not only on the environment, based on how those animals are raised, but on the people who consume those animals. And then you have people who are walking around who aren't properly nourished, which we know is a major issue. Not only that, their body's natural ability to fight off disease is not only non-supported now, but it's also being deteriorated. So this is why people are getting diseases. We're not eating proper, and we're destroying our ability to fight off disease. And it's clear, this article mentions, we've seen the rise of superbugs like MRSA, bugs that we cannot combat. That is scary, guys. Remember those aliens I was talking to you about earlier, saying how they wouldn't be like in your face, like take me to your leader. They're microscopic, also known as pathogens, also known as superbugs, also known as stop eating antibiotics. But it's not that simple. I know it's like overwhelming. Trust me, it overwhelms me. But like the article says, these companies are changing. In just the last year, we've seen a few of them adapt to the ways that people are demanding they be fed. Because it's important, and the more people you tell about this, the better. Because when you spend your dollars, you're voting. You don't only have to wait every 4 years to vote in some bullshit election. You vote every single time you feed your face or you spend a dollar. So make a decision. Who do you want to support? You decide. Things don't happen overnight, but I think that you can riot every time you open your wallet. My love goes out to all the families who are mourning lost loved ones. This past week has been full of tragedies, not only in my personal life, but my close loved ones and family, and across the country, as a result of police brutality. So I hear you, people protesting and doing what's unconventional, and the rest of the world does too. And I wish those people lots of love and courage, because it's not easy to oppose the masses. And it's not easy to say, this is wrong and I will not stand for this. And it takes a lot of courage. And you're not alone. So I just wanted to say thank you guys for listening. We are here Monday through Friday on this lovely station called UCY. And we are not the only show. There's so many other awesome programs that you guys can check out pretty much around the clock. And this upcoming week, I'm going to do my best to figure out how to not only pre-record so that I can have more availability to talk to the awesome people that I love to talk to who aren't available on Friday nights. And I'm going to try and release some video footage for you guys. I know I gave you a little teaser last year doing my show live via video. And I think I'm ready. If I could learn how to use this computer without any hitches, it just might be successful. So thanks, guys, for listening. Make sure you check out theantimedia.org. We are on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and here on UCY.TV. Our shows are archived on YouTube. There's lots and lots of programs from all of our hosts there. If you guys ever miss a chance to listen live, you can go there. Just go to YouTube and search The Anti-Media, and you will pull up our channel. It is within the UCY, so you can search Anti-Media or UCY, but we've got videos and tons of archive shows there for you guys to enjoy. Hello?
Hey, hold on. Don't finish off the show so soon. You still got like 3 minutes.
Calm your titties. How are you?
Hanging in there. Just happy my favorite soccer team won. How you doing, sis?
Good. Good. I only had like 5 minutes of computer issues tonight. How are you?
Well, just pretty much. Well, there were a lot of things I'd like to talk about, but I'll try to be as quick as possible. Antibiotics. I don't know what's the deal, whether if it's lack of good marketing, lack of budget, whatever, but I think we should need to either help out the, like, natural-based medicine to pretty much to, pretty much, I guess, either advertising or letting know that these other meds exist because, well, we're still going to be taking amoxicillin, Aleve, and all the other pharmaceutical mumbo-jumbo that will help us, that will relieve us and slowly kill us in the process. So, do you know any good brands?
Well, the thing with conventional antibiotics is that they not only they kill everything. They kill the pathogen or the invader, and they kill your flora. Within our bodies, we have flora, which is like it's a barrier between pathogens and us. And what it does is it helps regulate the ability to fight things off. And when an antibiotic comes in, it wipes out everything. So your body is more susceptible to infection after taking an antibiotic. And I But what we need to do to answer your question is to build up the flora in our bodies. We could do that by eating certain cultures and by maintaining a good pH.
Good pH. Hopefully that includes poultry-free cheeseburger or some. But anyways, Alien Encounters. Just to finish it up.
No, go ahead.
Let me see. Well, I know the Greys are not friendly at all with us because I am not in the mood to be a human medical guinea pig for people of outer space. I'll talk to you next.
Catch you guys next week. That's the end of our show.
Yo, here we go through the stereo.
This is JJ Inc.